Where it gets dangerous is if there's some L2 that gets attacked or exploited or breaks or somehow, and the attack is allowed to happen, and then EigenLayer and EigenLayer affiliates say, that's wrong, you did bad validation work, we need to slash you.
Right.
The slashing is their Ethereum mainnet stake. Ethereum validator nodes have security obligations for not Ethereum, and they're getting punished on Ethereum for it.
Hello and welcome to Dark Markets. I'm your host, former CoinDesk columnist and longtime crypto analyst David C. Morris. Today on the show, we're talking about two of the most interesting and strange new blockchain structures to have emerged over the past year. One, EigenLayer, is a so-called restaking protocol used to build another layer of functionality on top of Ethereum more efficiently, and to generate higher returns for Ethereum holders. The second product, Ethena, involves counterbalanced derivatives used to create a synthetic digital dollar. And again, it's generating extraordinary returns. EigenLayer and Ethena, though, have been greeted with a mix of enthusiasm and skepticism, including more than a few concerns that their complexity might hide major risks. That's especially true now that EigenLayer has swelled to control, at this recording, nearly $13 billion worth of Ethereum. My guest Zane Huffman, Chief Strategy Officer of Block, is an expert on tokenomic structures and personally trades distressed crypto assets. He sees the risks in EigenLayer and Ethena, but he thinks they may be overblown, largely because of the fresh memories of a similar yield-generating, elaborate structure that created digital dollars. He calls this form of financial PTSD Terra Lunaism. You probably know what he's referring to. It's been just under 2 years since the collapse of the Terra USD stablecoin set off a wave of dramatic bankruptcies and assorted catastrophes in 2022. Between May 7th and May 12th of that year, the supposed algorithmic stablecoin, called UST, lost its peg and collapsed to zero under the weight of its own broken Rube Goldberg design. The whole Luna ecosystem, with a total notional value of close to $40 billion, essentially disappeared in the space of a week. It was the spark that set off a firestorm of linked implosions that year, starting with Three Arrows Capital and playing a role in the decline of Digital Currency Group. It has since become clear that Terra USD wasn't just badly designed, but the product of a concerted fraud involving Terraform Labs, South Korean tech mogul Daniel Shin, and, it has been argued in recent court proceedings, Chicago-based Jump Trading, although Jump has not been formally charged with wrongdoing. To hear the story of Luna in depth, you can check out my documentary podcast, Crypto Crooks, which recounted it in season 2, titled Lunacy. Today, Zane and I tackle the question that's on the tip of everyone's tongue. Are Ethena, with its 12% yield, or EigenLayer, with its stacks on stacks of staking returns, the next Terra USD? Or are we all just a little paranoid? Today's episode also includes another bonus section for premium subscribers. Zane gives us his read on the different approaches to trading crypto, from the most risky to the most big brain, and gives some pointers on how to do crypto trading the smart way. Please welcome Zane Huffman to the Dark Markets Podcast. So welcome, Zane Huffman, to Dark Markets. And I think you're a very appropriate guest for a show about simultaneously the good and the shady part of crypto and financial innovation, because we'll get into it. Zane is the chief strategy officer of Block, a crypto company started by Jeff Garzik, who was one of the original Bitcoin developers. So Zane's very close to the center of kind of the entire history here. Zane, thanks for coming on.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for having me. Excited to dig in.
And I should say, if I hesitate when I say Zane, it's because we know each other under different, well, I know him under a different name that we won't discuss, but he's here in his full government capacity. Zane and I today are going to be talking about a few things. So starting with Zane is really insightful on the financial dynamics of on-chain products. And so we're going to talk through at least two of the most controversial and interesting ones around right now. I think we actually have different starting points on at least one of them, which is Eigenlayer, the restaking protocol that is using Ethereum's base security to build something else on top of it, which I find a little bit anxiety-inducing. Zane thinks it's great. And so we'll talk about that. And then perhaps even a hotter topic right now is Athena, the Arthur Hayes-backed stablecoin that uses, I don't even know exactly, it's some sort of weird perpetual something-something, but Zane, I think, is smarter than me on that, and we'll be able to actually explain it and then talk about that and the recent decision by MakerDAO. Zane, tell us about yourself and we'll get into, I think, the story of how you wound up in a C-suite role at a venerable crypto institution, given that you are ridiculously young. But first, just tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, so I'm at Block, where we do a bunch of different stuff, gaming, metaverse, mining. We have a big focus on DeFi. That's where I work. We have two DeFi protocols where I'm involved for a lot of the strategy decision making. That is Vesper, which is an on-chain yield aggregator, and then Metronome, which is a synthetic asset platform that prioritizes productive collateral. So the products work together. You deposit your assets onto Vesper, you can take them to Metronome and take out loans against them, you can multiply your exposure. Common themes that we're seeing now is staking, restaking, a lot of the controversy around Athena. Outside of Block, I have my own project as well called Deimos, which is not DeFi, not as appropriate for today, but we do essentially no orb required human authentication. And then personally, I would say I'm a degen. I am very active on chain. I have been for a long time. I have been before Block. I got into crypto really young. I was introduced in 2013. I was 15 at the time, and pretty soon into my journey, I started working professionally, doing freelance stuff, blog posts, journal stuff. Originally, got more on the tech side that led me into Block and kind of took me step by step to where I am today.
Great. And I should shout out for our premium subscribers at Dark Markets. There will be a short bonus section to this podcast where Zane talks a little bit about his on-chain activities and maybe give some tips. So stay tuned for that if you're a premium subscriber. First of all, is it Deimos, D-E-M-O-S, or is that how you spell it? Okay, great. So just to make sure people know where to find that, because on-chain identity is one of my big intellectual interests, at least, too. So maybe we can talk a little bit about Deimos. Do you pronounce it Deimos?
Deimos? Yeah. Deimos. Yep.
Okay. Yeah. We'll put a pin in that and get to it too. But let's start with the hot topics. Let's start with Eigenlayer and restaking. So, do you want to take a first stab? Because I will inevitably get something wrong. Do you want to kind of try and explain to the audience what Eigenlayer is, or maybe just more generally what the principle behind restaking is?
Yeah, definitely. So, restaking is the idea that you can use the Ethereum validator node security work to simultaneously secure another network. Essentially, you have people stake their ETH, they're participating in the proof of stake consensus on Ethereum. They can simultaneously opt in to do similar validation for another proof of stake network, an L2 call it. It's kind of a similar mechanic to back in the day we had merge mining, where the biggest example is if you're mining Litecoin, you can also mine Dogecoin. So that's kind of the philosophy of taking security resources and repurposing them. Eigenlayer is effectively a unified protocol to help organize this restaking activity. So a staker can essentially opt in to restake by using EigenLayer, where they can, I think the idea is they can get connected to EigenLayer secured networks. I don't believe that actual part is live yet. I think it's in the staging period, but that's the general idea behind how the protocol is intended to function.
And just to dig into a little bit more of the technicals, so if you're staking in Ethereum base layer, you basically send your ETH to a lockup contract that has a withdrawal delay, and you most of the time you're going to delegate that stake to a validator that will build blocks, put transactions in blocks, et cetera, just like a Bitcoin miner does. And then, you know, the reason it's a sacrifice is because you do have that withdrawal delay. You can't use your ETH anywhere else. And if either you as a validator or whoever you've delegated your stake to makes mistakes or is bad at their job or whatever, you can get what's known as slashed. You can have your ETH reclaimed. Now, I don't know how specific I want to get about EigenLayer, but generally the idea is that you can either use a liquid staking token like Steeth from Lido, or there's something called native staking that's slightly different. My question that I am still kind of trying to nail down answers on is whether it's EigenLayer or other systems, what exact privileges are you handing over to EigenLayer for control over, you know, either directly or indirectly, your stake base layer ETH. So my real concern structurally about these things is that base layer ETH at risk for slashing or getting unstaked somehow? And how does that play out?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so generally what you're delegating is your capital. If you're doing that, the home staking, restaking, that's a little bit different. But almost everyone is plugging their ETH into a delegated validator network like Lido, like someone else. And you're essentially saying, here's my ETH, go spin up more nodes, go do the staking validator work if you're doing it through EigenLayer, get ready to do the restaking work as well. As long as everyone behaves, as long as those validators behave, you're getting a return on your ETH, you're getting the interest from the validator rewards. If you're doing it through EigenLayer, you're getting the Eigen incentive, their points, there will be a token, allegedly. And yeah, you're hoping that the validator behaves. If they make a mistake, they can get slashed and you could wind up with less ETH than you had before.
Yeah. And so here's where we get to, like, you know, you've said you're a degen, so I can see the appeal of double rewards from that perspective, right? But there's kind of two dynamics that I see that are scary to me, frankly, is that when that's the motivation, you actually have, you know, a lot of incentive for every bit of staked ETH to wind up restaked, right? Like, you can wind up, and these protocols do, like, EigenLayer has a cap. They have a cap of how much ETH can be restaked into EigenLayer, which is why there have been, like, waiting lists and things like that. But kind of at a natural level, you would expect to see a trend towards 100% of staked ETH being restaked because people want to get those double rewards, right? And then my worry as a, you know, paranoid non-degen, basically, who's worried about the system, is that you then have all of that ETH subject to being unstaked through not the main Ethereum protocol, right? So EigenLayer then basically gets control over the level of security in ETH. So there's a catastrophic scenario where something goes wrong in EigenLayer, and then there's, like, maybe no staked ETH or a sudden drop in the level of staking and the level of validators that maybe could expose the base chain to an attack. So you're here to convince me that I'm wrong and talk me down from that apocalyptic nightmare. So is that a reasonable scenario? And, you know, what is the kind of counter argument, I guess?
Yeah. So the way that I see it, there's two main buckets of risk. One is the economic risk of there's some catastrophic event. A lot of ETH is getting, ETH collateral is, that's leverage, is getting captured. There's depegging on the liquid staking tokens. We can get more into that. The second, probably bigger bucket of concerns, and what you're alluding to, is does having so much consensus around a restaking layer, does that damage the inherent security of the Ethereum base layer?
Right.
Vitalik wrote a great article kind of outlining, I think he calls it like the slippery slope of restaking or something like that. When does it get dangerous? Where it could get dangerous is Eigenlayer, or the social consensus around Eigenlayer. What if it gets to a point where they are most concerned with the security of Eigenlayer and Eigenlayer mm-hmm. affiliates, not most concerned with the Ethereum, the security of Ethereum? What that means is the Ethereum validators who may be participating in restaking, they're supposed to also validate the Eigenlayer restaked L2s. They might not do it well. They might not really care. They might say, okay,
exactly,
I'm doing Ethereum validation. I'm opting in because I'm getting extra rewards. Something could go wrong. There could be malicious behavior, but I'm not really paying attention. I'm just passively validating.
Mm-hmm.
Where it gets dangerous is if there's some L2 that gets attacked or exploited or breaks or somehow, and the attack is allowed to happen because the validators are not paying attention because they're mm-hmm. Ethereum validators. And then Eigenlayer and Eigenlayer affiliates say, that's wrong. You did bad validation work. We need to slash you.
Right.
The slashing is their Ethereum mainnet stake. And yes. So the security of Ethereum gets eroded if we get to a point where so many Ethereum validator nodes have security obligations for not Ethereum, and they're getting punished on Ethereum for it. That's when mm-hmm. things get bad or dangerous from the network security point of view.
What I'm hearing is that at least the direction of my concern is valid, right? So, I mean, what is preventing that from happening, I guess? that deep slashing that then has an impact on Ethereum.
Yeah, it's a little bit of unexplored territory, frankly. I think the rational actor's assumption is that as long as a restaked L2 isn't more valuable than Ethereum, it shouldn't be much of an issue.
Mm.
Because unless you need to protect more value on this restaked L2 versus the value you're protecting on Ethereum mainnet, that social consensus that we need to fix what happened on the L2 by slashing on mainnet, that shouldn't happen. Mm-hmm. But those are economic forces, and there's kind of a maybe irrational social consensus layer, which could say everyone loves Eigen L2 restake chain. Everyone's on it, and we need to make sure those people are protected, and that could be bad for Ethereum. But I would say we're a ways off from even being in the realm of that being something that's happening. We're not there yet.
But that actually is specifically what Vitalik brought up in mm-hmm. as kind of his main concern in his piece about it, which is just that, like, the social aspect is, you know, that's the most dangerous thing to recruit from the base layer, was basically his way of putting it, was if you build something on top of Ethereum, like, you know, correct me if I get this wrong, but basically, like, if you build something on top of Ethereum that has enough of a critical mass to basically trigger some kind of uprising from users to demand that somebody goes in and does what in Ethereum is known as an irregular state change and, like, reverses something, like being pressured somehow to reverse or reorganize to correct an error on Eigenlayer or whatever restaking is the real big fear that Vitalik pointed out. I also wanted to, because you brought this to my attention, there actually was, short of a full meltdown, there are economic impacts and fallout from restaking fuck-ups. Mm-hmm. And you pointed out that this actually happened on BNB in 2021, mm-hmm. I believe. Can you talk about that case a little bit?
Yeah, I think it was the end of 2022. So separate from the social consensus layer, there is a... there's an economics layer of when you are wrapping and rewrapping and rehypothecating your ETH, you're taking your ETH, you're wrapping it into Lido staked ETH. That Lido staked ETH goes on to Eigenlayer. There's a, mm-hmm. a liquid restaking token, several on top of Eigenlayer. And essentially what that's doing is it's saying, here's a receipt of your ETH stake.
Mm-hmm.
You can use that. You can trade that. here's a receipt of your ETH stake that's deposited and then restaked. You can stake that, you can trade that, you can do whatever you want with that. And there are DeFi integrations and TVL that are built on top of that. And a lot of them are built on the assumption that this is worth whatever's at the bottom of the Russian nesting doll. This is, at the end of the day, this is worth one ETH.
Which, by the way, just to interject really quickly, this actually bugs the fuck out of me because there absolutely should be an economic discount based on technical risk for every wrapped asset. And the idea that we don't have like a theory behind that in crypto is like the root of all evil, in my opinion. But let's talk through this case first and then we'll get to the theory.
Yeah. So a meltdown happens a couple different ways. It could be an economic event a couple years ago when Celsius and 3AC were getting liquidated. They held a bunch of Lido staked ETH. This was before withdrawals were live, so they had to sell it. ST ETH depegged maybe 10%.
Right, yeah.
There was probably the most catastrophic event was this one on BNB chain. What happened was the largest BNB liquid staking token, which was Anchor BNB, the contract got exploited. I think someone stole the admin keys, and then they were able to mint an infinite number of Anchor staked BNB receipt tokens. They dumped that on the markets. There were the other LST tokens were trading against that token, so they all temporarily went to zero. There was some leverage yield protocols built on top of that. The people that were on there, they got liquidated. In my opinion, that's a good microcosm to look at to see what happens when there's a catastrophe, what the outcome is. I told you in DM, and we can get into this, when that happened, I sent a bunch of my money to BNB chain to profit off of the fallout. But yeah, that's...
Wait, can you get a little bit more specific on that? Because I think that's something that listeners are interested in. What was your strategy there?
Yeah, so this exploit happened. There was two other major LSTs. One was Stator Labs. I think that one's BNBX. And then there's another one. I don't remember the name of the company, but the ticker was STKBNB. Those LSTs were in markets traded against the exploited wrapper. Mm-hmm. So they went to zero because the hacker just took all the liquidity out that they could. People who were doing those leverage LP strategies, they were getting called and liquidated and selling at a discount. But the underlying asset, the BNB, was still there. And if you waited 2 weeks, you could withdraw it. So I took a bunch of my liquid capital over to BNB chain. I borrowed BNB on one of the lending markets, and then I bought discounted BNBX and STKBNB, 10, 20, 30% discount. I was driving when it happened, so I didn't get like the best 90%
discount. Wait a second, you did this while driving?
No. I was driving.
Okay, I was going to say, like, don't do this.
I was charging my car when I saw that it happened. I wasn't at my computer, so I was like a half hour late to the show. But I was able to buy these BNB liquid staking tokens, 10, 20, 30% discount. Fast forward 2 weeks, they're back to 1-to-1. Mm-hmm. And that kind of stuff happens a lot. For me, I take advantage of that a lot. Maybe we can get into that.
And just
that
to later. We'll get into it later, but just to kind of spell it out, I mean, I think we discussed this kind of personally beforehand that there are these like, or maybe I was talking with somebody else. You know, there's very different kinds of traders who work in this space. And what is most interesting to me about you is that your trading strategies mostly seem to be based on a very tight understanding of the relationship between the technical aspects of blockchain and the financial aspects. Mm-hmm. So you're like looking for opportunities where, you know, maybe for technical, like literally technology reasons, things get out of whack and you're able to go in there and take advantage of that, which I just like to highlight because I think it drives home the point of like how deep in this stuff you really have to be to make smart trades instead of just lucky trades, which I think is a different category of people. But so this BNB thing, it was contagion, I guess would be the word, on a small scale. How long did it take for that all to get sorted out?
I want to say maybe they swept it back together in a couple of weeks. It was on BNB chain, so they have, you know, some amount of control. I think they were able to freeze and revert so much of the damage. the Anchor team was able to essentially snapshot the real balances and then unwind and put out a new receipt. So the people who permanently lost money were the people who had
been liquidated, presumably,
leveraged positions and got liquidated, which is in all of these scenarios, that's kind of what happens. Is there some people who have to permanently forfeit at a loss. And then if you understand what's going on under the hood, you can come in and basically take advantage of that arbitrage. And that's how these mechanics are designed, is they are designed to be used in DeFi. So they're designed for people to come in and arbitrage and open market incentivize to keep things working normally.
Yeah, I mean, you were kind of a distressed asset acquirer at that point, in the way that people would do it in a normal market. But I do want to drill in on one thing that you mentioned, which is that BNB is definitely, well, at least reputed and probably at the time, if it's not still true, far more centralized and far more, you know, subject to revision and control than ETH is. You know, ETH notoriously, you had the DAO hack and rollback, but I'm not even sure that's possible now. You know, I don't know if they would be able to do that.
Unless restaking makes it possible.
Well, in the sense that, like, you would kind of be able to wipe the slate clean if things went really bad. Yeah, I guess so. But you would have to, you know, really do some extreme measures to do the kind of recovery on ETH that you saw in this BNB case. And of course, the BNB case was smaller than, probably smaller than Eigenlayer is already, I would guess.
Yeah. It was like, it was somewhere in like 100, 200 million range. It wasn't massive.
Definitely. I mean, I think that maybe you agree with a lot of my assessments on the risk side, but you still are, you know, you're pro this as a technology setup. Let me rewind briefly and ask you one more question, then I'll get the positive side, I guess. The simple question is, you know, you mentioned L2s. Eigenlayer is a kind of L2, but it's different. So can you just walk us through, you know, the standard L2 is a roll-up where you just write down your transactions every once in a while to an Ethereum block. How does Eigenlayer work differently than Optimism or something like that?
Yeah, the work of rolling up and writing back to Ethereum and validating the activity on the L2, that requires a set of nodes or validators on the L2 itself. I don't know how Optimism does it versus Arbitrum or how centralized or decentralized it is, but essentially you need to have a separate set of compute that is doing that work specific to the L2. The idea behind Eigenlayer and restaking is that we can just recycle the work being done on Ethereum layer one to also do that for the Eigenlayer secured L2.
Yeah, you mentioned it's literally the same validators.
Yes.
But that is, so that's interesting. Like if I delegate to an Ethereum validator and then also send money to, I mean, I think this is kind of what you were alluding to. If I send my liquid staking tokens to Eigenlayer, then that validator is now obligated to work on Eigenlayer 2. Do they have like choice as to that obligation? Or is that just if your stakers, if your delegators send to Eigenlayer, you're on the hook?
It's an opt-in with whoever the actual validators are. So Lido has so many validators. They're just validating the ETH L1. Mm-hmm. The capital that is going in, that's seeding the Eigenlayer restaking nodes, those are nodes that have specifically opted in to do the restaking work. So if a validator doesn't opt in, they're not forced to participate.
Okay, so that's reassuring at least. So we would probably, you know, not like unintentionally get to 100% restaked, you know, sounds like.
Yeah. The concern definitely would be more that there was a huge hack and we lost $5 bajillion dollars on this L2. Hey, Ethereum L1 validators, you need to help us to save it. Or the validators allowed this to happen. They need to be slashed as a punishment. Yeah.
So let's go to the positive. You like Eigenlayer. Mm-hmm. The pitch for this episode was restaking good. Mm-hmm. So restaking good. Why?
Restaking good. Well, for the users of EigenLayer, which are the L2s, in theory, they should get better, cheaper security in the same way that we see it, that we've seen it with merge mining back in the day. If an Ethereum validator is getting paid 4 or 5% and they can opt in and not have to do anything else and they get an extra payment from the L2, an extra couple of percent, that's a win for everyone. The L2s get cheaper security. The Ethereum validators get more income. That's good for ETH. That encourages more people to stake. I think there's good DeFi implications that we can get into. Generally, in a normal, steady state, everyone's a winner.
Yeah. And that is an interesting thing that I hadn't thought of, is that more like restaking rewards also mean more staking. So like theoretically, you're increasing security at a, as you said, steady state, leaving aside the technical risk or whatever. So that's interesting. But what about the DeFi implications?
Yeah, so this is something that I have a lot of emphasis on. I've written a few articles on this, but there's this notion that the more risk-free yield, we'll call it, on the network, the more DeFi energy we get and the more stuff we can do with DeFi. Taking it back to the beginning, if we look at liquid staking tokens, that was a huge boom for ETH DeFi. Instead of having my ETH token that doesn't get me anything, I have this one-to-one wrapper that gets me 4% and I can use it as collateral, or I can leverage up my access to that yield. That drives interest rates up, that drives access to yield up. The DeFi protocols that are exposed to these different tokens, they're all winning, and we've seen a ton of that. Restaking is another layer of that. If I'm getting my 4% and I'm getting, right now it's like an extra bajillion percent because it's points and it's an airdrop, but let's say a year from now, the EigenLayer nodes, they're not getting 4%, they're getting 8%. That's awesome. That drives more activity. I can borrow naked ETH at 7%, leverage up and get more yield. And then it's driving demand for staking, which means there's less ETH supply. It drives demand for ETH block space, which means more transactions, higher fees, more burn. It's like, it's a very...
It sounds like a virtuous cycle, maybe.
It's a virtuous flywheel until things break. But I don't think the way that things are situated right now is in a place where we need to worry about things breaking.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Do you want to move on to talk about Athena? Is there anything else really crucial for people to understand about EigenLayer?
I have one thing to add, which is this bleeds into the Athena conversation as well. But part of my, call it risk appetite for being exposed to restaking, trading these distressed assets, is this understanding that at the end of the day, even if there's some big blow up and there's a lot of mess, at the end of the day, there is a hard asset that I want to own underneath it all. I don't mind buying a de-stressed LST or maybe in the future a de-stressed LRT because I know I like ETH. I want to own as much ETH as I can. Eventually, I can pull out that ETH as long as it's not something that's broken. If it's just market forces. And I don't think people recognize that a lot of the times. There's this kind of notion, there's this misconception. I call it like Terra Luna-ism, which is like something is either a binary safe or it's risky and it's going to blow up like Terra Luna. That's not really the reality. Holding ETH in your hardware wallet is less risky than depositing your ETH into Lido staked ETH, but it's still not that risky. Taking that Lido staked ETH, putting it on EigenLayer, more risky, still not that risky. Wrapping that into a liquid restaking token, again, more risky, but still like magnitudes less risky than Terra Luna was.
Because there's no financial structure per se around these things. There's no leverage in restaking as the restaker, right?
There is, but that's on the DeFi side. So
right, but I'm saying the actual act of restaking, you are not leveraged.
Right, right. You can at the end of the day, you can unwind it all back to the underlying one ETH. It's not, if we want to transition into Athena, I disagree with what the Aave co-founder said of they're minting against thin air into thin air. that's something you could say about Terra Luna. It's not appropriate to say about Liquid restaking tokens or to say about Athena. There's definitely risk involved, but it's not infinite risk destined to go to zero. It's, you know, there's a possibility that there can be distress.
Well, so that's a good little preview, but I'm going to let's take a slight detour in the middle and let you do, it's not an ad, but we'll call it a little plug for Deimos. Do you want to talk about the identity project?
Yeah, sure. So a few years ago, as part of a DAO volunteer nerd collective, doing different DAO experiments, we came up with a really elegant solution to solve civil resistance and widespread instances on chain. So a civil resistance or a civil attack is when someone takes on a lot of different accounts or identities to get an unfair advantage in the system. It's very common in crypto because transactions are inherently financial and accounts are inherently permissionless. So airdrops in particular, people spin up 100 or 1,000 accounts and they'll get 100 or 1,000 airdrops. And the real user with one account gets 100 or 1,000 times less than they were supposed to. We have a solution for civil resistance, which is, we joke, we say orb-free human authentication. We use a very simple selfie-like biometric scan that can prove if a user who comes onto our app is or is not unique, and if they are or are not human. If they pass those tests, they get a soulbound token on their wallet, and then any project that wants to gate their airdrop or their token launch or whatever, they just gate behind a balance of this token. So our whole thing is easy, universal, accessible to everyone, civil resistance. There are other ways to go about proof of personhood that are more cumbersome. WorldCoin, at the very least, you have to get in your car and go to an appointment. Some of the like passport type proof of person stuff, you have to go on a bunch of different protocols and you have to onboard. There's a level of technical knowledge required. Our whole thing is this is the very easiest way that someone can prove they're a unique person. Nothing more, nothing less. And it's a very easy way that a project can gate behind it without torturing their users to go jump through a bunch of hoops.
And where can people go to find out more about Deimos?
Twitter's probably best. We're at Deimos_global. You'll see it in my profile as well. From there, you can see the website. The app is live. We're pre-token. So there is a points program, which legally I cannot say what that means, but you can infer. we just launched a little more than a month ago. Have a bunch of integrations in the pipeline, so there are projects that are gating their airdrops behind us, that are gating, there's token launch pads, NFT creator studios, those are coming out soon, so there will soon be a lot of things you can do once you sign up and enroll.
I love it, because I don't know if you're familiar with this stuff, but I have serious issues with WorldCoin, and like even more of them since Sam Altman has also gone on to do other things, and I don't like the orb. So alternatives are great, and I mean, it sounds very simple. If it's just you have your database of however many people wanted to get verified, and as long as it's just one, and you have the database or the data or whatever hashed whatever you do, that's all it takes. You don't have you just have to compare it against other people. It's not that, doesn't sound that complicated, and it sounds like it's workable. So yeah, good. War against WorldCoin. So now let's move on to Athena, which I have to say right up front, and I hope you're going to catch me before I fall, because I have no clue what this thing is, except that it's a stablecoin based on some kind of arbitrage, which again, as a boomer, I find inherently suspect, so you're going to have to talk me down. But first, let's just talk about what Athena is. And, you know, this is an idea proposed by Arthur Hayes just a couple of years ago, I think, that is now kind of tearing up the charts, right?
Yeah, I will be more high level. It's a centralized exchange off-chain stuff, which is not my domain. I'm an on-chain maxi, but at a high level, it's a... I believe they say it's a delta neutral perps backed stablecoin. What that means is that people can go to Athena with their ETH, or I think they support STETH and some other collaterals. And every dollar of ETH you deposit, you mint a dollar of this stablecoin, ETH is volatile collateral, obviously. If ETH goes down, right. It's under collateralized. So the way that they hedge against that is that for every dollar of ETH they're holding or longing, they have a dollar of ETH that they are shorting at the same time. They generate yield because we're in a bull market and people are trading a lot, and they do this activity on centralized exchanges where they can arbitrage across the different exchanges and optimize for the funding rates they're participating in. So I don't know what it looks like on like Binance or Bybit or whatever exchanges they're using, but they're getting paid to have their ETH there, and they're getting paid to borrow it, or they're getting paid to have it borrowed. I don't know which is the profitable side.
Mm-hmm.
And then they pass on that yield to the stablecoin holders.
And like, this is where I get, I think, justifiably paranoid, because the yield rate on Athena right now is like 38%.
Mm-hmm.
So like, is that just like people are trying to get long ETH and that benefits them? Or do you have a sense of how that yield works at this point? Because I mean, if you're hedging long and short, like theoretically, you're not coming out that far ahead, except that people are sort of bullish ETH right
mm-hmm.
now.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, like where does that yield come from at that level?
Yeah, so my understanding is that when markets are very volatile, very hot, going up a lot or going down a lot, there's huge demand on exchanges to trade, to borrow and leverage or short.
Yeah.
I believe the access to yield is much lower in a slow sideways market. So if things are, mm-hmm. I believe that if things are going up a lot or going down a lot, you can generate a lot of yield, and you can do it at scale, as they have demonstrated. If things are going sideways, that's when it's difficult to keep the whole thing running profitably, I believe.
Yeah. And so when you describe them going to all of these different exchanges and being essentially liquidity providers, I guess, not liquidity providers, lenders, but... You know, does that mean that Athena is really like an actively managed fund, essentially?
Yeah, that's my understanding. And I believe that's a big differentiator between other stablecoins that work similarly.
Mm-hmm.
There are other, I don't know for sure, but I believe the term is Delta neutral perp collateralized stablecoin.
Mm.
There are several of those that already exist on chain, but they're intended to be decentralized on-chain. They're only doing that activity on the different on-chain perp exchanges. So GMX or Quenta or whatever else. There's not a huge amount of activity on-chain versus on Binance, on OKX, on right. Bybit, on whoever. And so their big differentiator is somehow they have been granted access to do this work on all these different exchanges, and they have a huge access to liquidity and volume and APY that their competitors do not.
Which you can assume has a lot to do with Arthur's involvement.
Yeah, you would think.
I also noticed that, and we can talk about whether this is materially true or just kind of technically true, but based on that nature of it being an actively managed fund, I assume they are trying to stay away from the United States. And I saw some reference in their documentation to, you know, who some users can access it and some, at least mm-hmm. theoretically, can't.
Yeah, I think they're geofenced is what I saw.
Yeah. And they can do that, I guess, a lot easier because they're not decentralized.
Yeah, they have, you know, I'm not an expert on the regulation side, but I can anticipate they can make a much stronger argument of we are actually barring activity because the protocol itself is being actively managed. It's not a smart contract mm-hmm. that you can work around the front end. I mean, there is a smart contract component, of course, but I would anticipate they have a better legal protection than an on-chain alternative, perhaps.
Yeah, and I mean, I know a decent amount about the regulatory side, and obviously I haven't looked at it in huge depth, but I mean, my assumption is that as long as you're not in the United States, somebody is probably comfortable regulating this as a financial product that just happens to be a crypto mm-hmm. thing. So, you know, I don't know what their domicile situation is, but it's not like they're utterly Wild West. They're just offering a trade.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, do you, from a systemic perspective, and maybe in light of just what's happening right now, which is a lot of growth in that protocol, I mean, do you see risks there? What do you think is like a situation where there could be a problem or things to watch out for if you're long Athena, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I would say a few things. One, it is expensive to run a stablecoin. You need to spend a lot of money or points, or they're doing points and airdrops right now, to keep people incentivized to having a stablecoin maintain its peg. It does seem like if they get to a point where they cannot capture as much yield as they are now, it would be a lot harder to continue operating at the size that they are.
Mm-hmm.
They do offer redemptions. I understand that it's not immediate, or it's not all immediate, because most of their collateral is sitting on exchanges, not in a smart contract. So it does seem like if market conditions turn sour, they could have difficulty sustaining the level of volume in TVL they're at right now. They could get in a position where potentially they even sustain some losses, but in terms of losses, we're talking about interest rates going negative and getting the short end of the stick with arbitraging the rates and having to pay more. It's not like Terra Luna, where if market conditions go sour, the money's gone. There's nothing backing it. Every stable coin is backed by a dollar, or maybe more than a dollar, of these positions on the exchanges.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's so. I'm not a savvy enough operator to, really have an immediate intuitive grasp of how like a counterbalancing short works. But, if Ethereum goes to zero, we've got way bigger problems than whether Athena is still liquid. But, barring something that extreme, you lose 50% of your principal and then you get that back. I mean, I guess it. If you're doing a standard short, does that pay out in like dollars on Binance or something?
I would assume that the way they're hedging it is they're not exposed to price fluctuation up or down. But I guess that's part of the concern, is because it's a custodian, we don't get to see it. And maybe they are ineffective custodians and they screw up somehow.
I mean, that and it's not just about that team too, right? Because if they're operating through exchanges, then they're exposed to exchange risk too. So I guess those are just important things for people to keep in mind if you're going to play in this venue. But from your degen perspective, right? Like, what is the benefit to the space aside from, we're not going to get 38% yield forever, right? But functionally, on an ongoing basis, if it goes to, let's say you're just getting the staking pass through and it's 4%. What is the benefit to having Athena around as a stablecoin, just assuming it works fine?
Yeah, universally, access to yield is very important, as well as access to different yield sources. So I think the liquid staking tokens and the restaking is very important by enabling new ETH yield. This is a great way that DeFi is benefiting from accessing this exchange-denominated yield that otherwise isn't accessible on-chain, in a similar way that tokenized T-bills are great. And what we see, and the reason why Maker and Aave are fighting about it, but both Maker and Aave are supplying loans to the token holders on-chain, is that if I'm earning 38%, hell yeah, I'll take out a loan for 25% and then leverage back in.
Right.
Aave and Maker are getting paid. It's a little bit different. Aave, it's peer-to-peer. But Aave depositors are getting paid 25%. Maker's getting paid 25%. Mm-hmm. That's yield that has kind of downstream effects in the DeFi ecosystem. Maker earning more profit means they can offer a higher DAI savings rate, which means there's a better on-chain savings account product.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like the cliche saying of like a rising tide lifts all ships. That's totally true in DeFi. The more yield there is total, the more everyone's earning, the more capacity there is in DeFi to take on TVL, all that good stuff.
Yeah. But see, this also gets to, I think, well, we should talk a little bit more about MakerDAO, but I also just want to highlight from a risk perspective that you mentioned that Athena right now is spending a lot of money on incentives, that yield is definitely not sustainable. And so when the DAI lending is based on this idea that you have this huge
alpha between your borrow and your yield. I mean, that basically sets you up for some serious volatility in the entire space at some point, because if it reverses, people are going to pull out, like DAI, TVL drops, right? I'm not wrong about that.
Yeah, so there, I would say there's kind of two meltdown scenarios that you kind of see with these types of products. Is Athena sustains a significant loss. I don't know what an appropriate estimate would be. I don't think they lose all their money. Maybe they lose 20% of their collateral or something like that.
Mm-hmm. This is a hypothetical.
I don't know if that's an appropriate thing. Maybe 10% is more appropriate. Maybe 50% is more appropriate. But there is some catastrophic event, and Athena is now underbacked by 20%. Either they shut down the protocol, and every stablecoin holder takes a 20% haircut. They get 80 cents back. Or they don't shut down the protocol, and there may be a bank run where people are rushing to redeem.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, it's not 2 billion that's 20% unbacked. It's 400 million.
500 million that's 80% unbacked.
10% backed, or whatever the breakdown is. So both of those instances are bad. The latter is more bad for someone who is offering loans against it.
If it
goes down to 80% and Maker is lending against it, they still have the ability to redeem that collateral, liquidate those loans.
And then you probably also have like a sort of an external doom loop there, because you would be getting people buying the Athena stablecoin for 20 cents, and then there's probably some shenanigans somewhere that people would get up to. So that becomes like a bad feedback loop too.
Yeah, like if there's a lending market that has hard-coded the stablecoin to a dollar, and someone buys it for 20 cents and deposits it into the lending market and then pulls the real assets. Yeah, that's been a contagion event that's happened in a few places where that happened to a lot of some of the markets supporting UST. They just hard-coded to a dollar, and then all of a sudden the entire lending market is defaulted.
Yeah, and I mean, UST had other internal dynamics that were similar even without the hard coding, but it does sound like, obviously we're talking about a lot of what ifs and a lot of unknowns, but it does sound like you could get something sort of similar to UST in use, not within Athena, but like in the interaction between Athena and other systems in a very specific scenario.
Yeah. I mean, it's, in my risk spectrum model, I think Athena is probably more risky than liquid restaking tokens. Let's say that's the most risky on the east side right now. I think Athena is probably more risky than that, still less risky than Terra Luna.
Oh, yeah.
The catastrophic event is Athena's 100% collateral somehow melts down as however low as it goes. UST was the opposite, where they had zero collateral.
Right.
they were working up a backing, and they had like, I don't know, it was like 20% backed when it finally blew up or something like that.
Which like is a whole other conversation, but being 20% back is actually worse than being 0% backed. But we can, that's another topic, I guess.
I believe it.
So real quick, and we're getting towards the end of our formal time here, and then we'll go into overtime and talk about being in a degen. But last topic, we have had, and this will be a while before this comes out, so a lot more will have happened. But in the last few days, we've had a big discussion about DAI and Maker and their engagement with Athena. Tell us, you mentioned it, but spell out what they're doing, and then we'll talk about the controversy really briefly.
Yeah, so DAI has a module that allows them to mint DAI into different lending markets. So it's not uncollateralized. They mint DAI into different Morpho vaults. So they have a Morpho vault where you can deposit the USDE stablecoin, and you can borrow DAI against it. That DAI that's been minted is not circulating until a collateralized loan is taken out against it. So that's how it's safe.
So it's almost double collateralized at that point.
Which part's double collateralized?
The DAI.
Yeah, it's collateralized by it's collateralized by the USDE, which is collateralized by the ETH on the exchanges. So,
but then it's also a collateralized loan.
Yeah. So that's how the DAI is accessed is through through the loan. So Maker has very quickly deployed I think $1 billion in lending capacity to different USDE vaults, which is Athena USD, on Morpho, which is a permissionless lending market. It allows you to spin up your own vaults.
And for reference on that number, MakerDAO's TVL right now in total is $6.3 billion. So that's a huge lever up.
Yeah, it's a huge lever up, and it's a huge fast lever up. I believe that's the criticism of Aave. Aave also has plans to support some amount of Athena USDE collateral, but a smaller amount, like 5% of their TVL or something like that, or maybe even less than that. This has just happened a couple days ago. So after Maker did this, the Aave founders put out a proposal saying we want to remove DAI from the platform or remove it as collateral. So you can't take loans against DAI. And their rationale, which I think is a fair rationale to have, is Maker should not move so quickly if they still want to be regarded as this A-tier blue chip DeFi stablecoin collateral. That's a reasonable argument to make. I don't appreciate the way that they went about communicating it, which was DAI is minting. I believe the phrase was DAI minted $1 billion out of thin air into a thin air collateral. Which is that's Terra Luna-ism. It's not uncollateralized. It's not 2x uncollateralized. It's riskier. It's definitely riskier. But it's
and I mean, I just to be transparent. I mean, I definitely absorbed that aspect of it, and it's just literally incorrect that you know I thought they were just printing the DAI basically based on the way Aave put it.
Right. And then that makes you they're printing it into they're Terra Luna-ing, but they're not.
Yeah.
On the risk factor, that it's maybe further along the risk curve than they should be, but it's not on the far end. It's somewhere closer to the middle.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so that's the state of play right now. Mm-hmm. Probably a lot will have changed by the time this airs, but it's at least a description of the basic situation. Thanks, Zane Huffman, for coming on Dark Markets. We're going to wrap up our main segment here. And then for premium subscribers, we're going to talk a little bit about trading in the after. But where can people find you? Talk us through a little bit about Block again, just so you get some plugs in, and we'll go into the overtime.
Yeah, so I'm Green Jeff online. I was Anon once upon a time. You can find me.
Oh, okay, good. So I was trying not to dox you, but you're doxed already. So
yeah. Works. Oh yeah, no problem. I'm at Jeff the Dunker. Just JEFF the Dunker on Twitter.
Just so you know, that's you're going to be 50 years old, and that's still going to be your screen name. So I hope you're happy with it.
Yep. On my Twitter, you can see Vesper and Metronome from there, where I work at Block, where I lead a lot of our DeFi strategy. And you can also see a link to Deimos, which is my personal project.
Nice. Awesome. Jeff / Zane, which by the way, I didn't even bring this up. Zane is my middle name. I might've mentioned this to you before, but, so we actually have the same name. thanks for coming on the show. And, yeah, if you're a premium subscriber, stay tuned. We'll talk about some trading ideas.
Awesome.
The Dark Markets podcast is edited and with production assistance by Eleanor Paul. Music is by Altus Nomina. Writing, hosting, and production, flaws and all, are by me, David Z. Morris. Dark Markets is a listener-supported production. Subscribe at darkmarkets.xyz to receive the Dark Markets newsletter. And consider a premium subscription to get bonus podcast content and full access to early drafts of my book in progress on Sam Bankman-Fried. Thanks for listening. We'll be back in 2 weeks.